This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas. A rather blurry Paul Williams. Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Sure. It's good being in the trenches.
Yeah, I like to use that term, obviously, metaphorically, because we're talking about the information war. What's funny, though, is Operation Gladio was a hell of a lot more than an information war, wasn't it?
Well, Operation Gladio, it was one of the most significant undertakings, I believe, of the 20th century and the 21st century. It's affecting everybody right now. It never stopped. It began in 1947 and really 1945. But it never really stopped. It's still going on.
Well, okay. Before we talk about that, what is your background?
My background is, well, it's extensive. Let me begin by saying that I was originally trained as a medieval philosopher. My PhD is in medieval philosophy from Drew University. My dissertation was on Peter Abelard, who's a 12th century philosopher whose works have never been translated into English. So that's how I started. I began as somebody who was, you know, I mean, I was very specialized training and a very demanding training. And once again, most of my dissertations in Latin. I graduated in 1976. And after that, I started a newspaper in Scranton, Pennsylvania. It's called the Metro. It was named one of the best newspapers in the country by the by the Pennsylvania Newspaper Publishers Association. I published that newspaper for about 6 years, and I used to write about the mafia extensively, including the five families from New York and crime families throughout the country. One of the centers of organized crime in America happens to be Northeast Pennsylvania, where I live. So there was an organized crime unit there was headed by Vince McGraw of the FBI, and I later became associated with that. I worked for them for over 6 years, and my work with the FBI resulted in arrest and convictions. And my work in dealing with organized crime in America, in this area, resulted in me coming upon the sorry, sordid tale of Gladio, which consumed a great deal of my attention. I've written 20 books. I would say that 12 of them were just leading up to the work on Gladio, which was very extensive, very well documented. You have, I believe, about 1,800 footnotes in there to very good sources, including FBI documents. So it was a work that it's probably my favorite book. I've written 20, and I'm a New York Times bestselling author. So when I say that, I don't say it lightly.
What was Operation Gladio, and who formed it?
What happened was after World War II, in Germany, you had a very volatile environment. You had an environment in which the communists were coming to fore. And we're gaining footholds naturally in Germany because, you know, half of Germany went to the communist, and they were gaining footholds in other countries throughout the world, including, and most notably, Italy and France, Spain. I mean, they were gaining monumental footholds. So what happened in 1945 is that the members of OSS, the Office of Strategic Services in the United States, began working with the former echelon of the Nazi Party, including Gerhard Gehlen. They established a stay-behind unit in Germany so that communism would not spread. The unit was known, the members of the unit were known as werewolves. And that was so successful in thwarting the spread of communism that the OSS began establishing other secret armies throughout Europe, principally, once again, one in Italy, where it was almost on the verge of becoming a communist country. So we had this vast network that was underground of stay-behind units. Many of them were commanded by American officers, And what happened was the rise of communism in Italy under the PCI, the Italian Communist Party, in 1947 became so troublesome that the Office of Strategic Services had to go a major transformation. And that transformation, once again, was initiated to expunge the communists from Italy, because if they had a strategic location in Italy, then they would have really access to the rest of the Western world, especially the United States. So what happened was the Office of Strategic Services morphed into something called the CIA. The members of the CIA were members of the very richest of the rich, the most elite families in the United States, including the Mellons, the Rockefellers. The CIA originally was funded with millions and with over $40 million just from the Rockefellers alone. And that was matched by gifts from other very elite families. But what happened was the need for cash became more and more and more intense. Once again, the Italian government was about to topple. So the CIA became actively involved with fascists in Italy and members of the Christian Democratic Party to do away with, once and for all, the PCI, the Italian Communist Party. Now, Jeremy, I'm going to tell you why this was important, especially for the Vatican. Once again, we had to work, since you're dealing with Italy and the Italian government, and you're dealing with guerrilla tactics there, immediately brought them, brought the newly formed CIA into a close relationship with the Sicilian Mafia. This was nothing new. Lucky Luciano and Vito Genovese and Don Callo, all these people worked with the U.S. forces during World War II, especially to launch the invasion of Italy. So the connection was already there. But the CIA began using the Sicilian Mafia to disrupt the activities of the Communist Party in Italy. What the church became actively involved, because the Christian Democratic Party that was going to be toppled there was the party of the Roman Catholic Church. If that government was toppled, if the communists gained power in Italy, the Vatican would have lost its status as a sovereign nation within a sovereign state. Vatican City is a separate country. It's not ruled by Italian law, not ruled by the Italian government. It's an entity due to the Lateran Treaty of 1927. It's an entity, 1929. It's an entity unto itself. So if the communists came to power first, the church would have lost many of its financial holdings in Italy, which were vast. They would have lost their tax-exempt status there. It was a fate that they would have been driven back into poverty. It was a matter of complete urgency. And once again, that was the formation of the CIA. What happened, Jerem, is that the money, we got to realize that we started out with stay-behind units to thwart communism in Germany. We also had to use stay-behind units in France because the threat of communism was there. The Netherlands, Sweden, okay, Norway, Spain, like I said before, all these various countries we needed, where communism was getting a foothold, including countries in South America, we started to put in stay-behind units. Now think of the cost of that. The enormous cost, even to uproot communism in Italy. Just think of the cost. When you're talking about a movement that had already taken over municipal governments throughout, this was a massive, massive undertaking. It was so massive that American celebrities like Frank Sinatra and you were going into, were broadcasting in Italy, almost every major movie star, to urge people not to support the communists. We established Radio Free Europe. Primarily, it was a CIA operation, but that wasn't enough. It wasn't enough. They were still gaining footholds. So strong arm tactics were needed, mainly to prevent the people from voting. And there were many murders committed, assassinations, pogroms throughout Italy, so that this would not occur. But once again, let's look at it in terms of Gladio. You have a huge operation that was originally funded by the Rockefellers and Mellons and American bankers, incredibly wealthy, including the Rothschilds in England. Money was running out. Even they did not have enough money to sustain Gladio. So what happened was they had to come up with a new source of revenue. Now, what most people don't realize when they hear about the CIA, they don't realize that it was formed in 1947, as I said, under General William Wild Bill Donovan, Allen Dulles, and James Anglican, a whole slew of very powerful figures within the OSS. But the CIA, when it was formed under the Truman administration, was not supported by the U.S. government. There was no revenue from the U.S. government. So where could the money come from? It was a covert operation. Naturally, you couldn't say, you know, we're going to allocate $1 billion a year, you know, to support these stay-behind units and have the American taxpayer pay for it, and it couldn't be made public. So they had to come up. They were urgent to come up with a source of revenue. And they came up with the idea. And a guy by the name of Paul E. Hallowell. Do you want me to stop?
The Vatican.
Okay. A guy by the name of Paul E. Hallowell, during World War II, formed a division, a military division called the Flying Tigers. The purpose of the Flying Tigers is this. You see a movie called The Flying Tigers, you think, oh, what a great patriot. No. The Flying Tigers, their task was to support Chiang Kai-shek in China, the National Chinese Army. They were fighting not only the Japanese at that time, but they were fighting Mao, the rise of Mao Zedong. So what Hallowell was doing in China during World War II is he formed something called Air Supply and the Flying Tigers, which would fly planes into the Golden Triangle of Laos, Burma, now Myanmar, and Thailand, where poppy fields were sprouting through all over the countrysides. And they would transport the poppies to China, where they were refined into heroin by Chiang Kai-shek in the National Army. Hallowell was doing that. He was an American OSS officer. He had already established that. Okay, that a route. This is very pivotal because people won't understand what's going on with our conversation unless you come to terms with this fact. So Hallowell, 1947, you got Gladio units. You have the threat in Italy, which was existential to the church, to our country, to really the Western world, NATO, the West. So what happened was Hallowell said, well, if we used heroin to support the National Army in China, perhaps we can use heroin to support covert activities by the newly formed CIA.
Oh.
It made sense. So once again, he presented these ideas to William Donovan, to Dulles, to the officials of the CIA who were desperate for cash. Once again, no money has ever been allocated for covert weapons from the U.S. Treasury. None. Not a dime. To this day, you hear the CIA is operative, including throughout Africa, operating throughout the entire world, no source of public revenue. How do they get their money?
I mean,
that was a question. How did this happen? What happened was Hallowell presented the first members of the CIA was forming, with this idea that, look at, if we can go to this Golden Triangle and provide heroin for the Chinese National Army, we should be able to use heroin to support Gladio. So what happened was the original members of the CIA, the founding members of the CIA, thought this was a grand idea. And the idea was that when the heroin would flow, you've got to realize that in the United States, during the 1940s and throughout most of the 1950s, heroin was virtually unknown. I mean, people weren't taking smack. There were no opium dens. There was no crack cocaine. There was none of that in the United States. What happened was Hallowell and company, after gaining, they had access to this opium, and they needed the laboratories in Marseille, controlled by the Sicilian mafia, to refine the opium into number four, even number three heroin that could be mainstreamed and used by people. So what they figured is, hey, you know, there are jazz clubs popping up. There's this new thing called jazz. And this is popping up throughout the United States. And these people were people that could be expended. There were members, there were blacks. And they attended jazz clubs. And suddenly you had heroin flowing into the jazz club. First cases of really massive supplies of heroin flowing into the jazz clubs. And you had these great, for an unknown reason, almost immediately, you had these great jazz artists suddenly dying of overdose. It was a great success. The heroin trade became established in the United States to support Gladio in Italy and throughout Europe. It was a grand and glorious success. They had enough money for their operations in Italy and throughout like continental Europe. The Italian Democratic Party, against all odds, against all logic, lost the 1947 elections. The church was still triumphant there. The Christian Democrats prevailed. Pope Pius the 12th was still very much in a force to contend with. But the operation continued, so there had to be a steady supply of income. You got to understand this. Because once again, you had ongoing covert activities, including at that time, the CIA became toppling governments in Iran, in Turkey. There was even an attempt to kill Charles de Gaulle. This was all Gladio. Throughout South America, all this upheaval, this was all supported by these funds.
You were mentioning Latin America. Did they have involvement in Africa?
Oh, absolutely. Absolute to this day. From the get-go, any place where a communist could establish a foothold, Africa was a prime threat because there were so many natural resources, so great wealth in Africa. All of that was controlled by the CIA. What happened in Egypt, all of that was, what was happening throughout the Sudan, what happened in Egypt, all of that was part of this. Oh, yeah. Even what was taking place in southern Africa, in Cape Town, was total. Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a threat. This was really a war for control of the world. How are you going to control the world unless you control the world's wealth? Where does the wealth come from? Natural resources. So naturally, yes. To this day, you're very much a part of it. Africa is the entire continent, which is so vast. You know, I mean, people in the United States don't realize what a gigantic continent Africa really is. You know, you could put Europe, the United States, South America, Australia, all in Africa, and you still have tons of room. So getting back to, if I could get right back to the jazz clubs and the heroin, more and more and more money was needed as Gladio continued to expand. So in the poppy fields of Southeast Asia, as I mentioned before, were the primary source. They were using heroin from Turkey at that time, but the primary source would come from Southeast Asia. And that's why you had the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. The major source of wealth, there were commodities in the United States, commodities throughout the world, commodities where you are. There are two of the world's most valuable commodities. I can tell you one, heroin. In any case, what happened, so those poppy fields had to be cultivated. They established a route where the heroin would go from Southeast Asia through corporations like the World Commerce Corporation through sea supply. They would be flown, they would be shipped to Marseille, refined, and then transported to Cuba. And from Cuba, which was then throughout the 1950s, of course, you know, under Batista, it was not a communist country, and from Cuba to the jazz clubs throughout the country. The members of the CIA always said that it would be confined to the lower stratas of American society, that it would not reach the middle class. That's what they believed, that it would only be used by blacks. And once again, they were not people of a great deal of significance in the United States at that time. So that's where that pipeline came from. And that's the background of Gladio, from which we can, you know, we can discuss other things. But it became more and more sophisticated, of course, as time went on. When the North Vietnamese prevailed in Vietnam, and the downfall of Saigon, you know, new sources of poppies had to be found. But let me go back just 1 sec, Vietnam. How the whole thing was a scam, because there was so much money involved. Most people are very naive, and they think that, oh, money can be transported so easily, you can just get bags of gold. No. In order for money to be transported, you need banks. For your liquidity, you need the banks. Without the banks, you don't have that. You need a bank. Originally, the number one bank that controlled all of this money, covert money, was the Vatican Bank. Pivotal would understand. The Vatican Bank. That explains the fact that even the most secret U.S. documents, including the development of the hydrogen bomb, all these things, were not kept in the United States. They were kept in the Vatican. The Vatican was very much a part of this. And you got to realize the Vatican Bank, this is important to explain, the Vatican Bank is not a bank that's monitored by the International Monetary Fund or by any outside agency. The Vatican Bank is a sovereign and separate entity within a sovereign state, Vatican City. The members of the Roman Curia, that means the cardinals, they have no access to the Vatican Bank. Only the Pope does. It's owned and controlled by the Pope. What happens in the Vatican Bank, when the church releases its finances, they right now they say, oh, we really don't have much money. You know, we need you to contribute. Well, the real wealth, including the wealth from the rat lines and from the Nazis, the wealth from the heroin trade. That is where the wealth of the today's Roman Catholic Church exists under Pope Francis. He has done nothing. You still don't know the transactions within the Vatican Bank. There's no internal audit. There's no exterior audit. There's no means of people getting access to the true holdings, but they're vast. They're vast.
It's fascinating. Just on the Vatican Bank, are you saying that it exists sort of outside the central banking system? It's not connected to the BIS, etc.?
Absolutely. People from Moneyval, for instance, have no access to it. And all of the disclosures, this financial disclosures from the Roman Catholic Church, that there'll be a phrase at the end. This is the phrase, with the exception of the IOR, that's the Vatican Bank, which is supposed to be the Institute for Religious Works. The Vatican Bank, the last time in the 1970s, I noticed, it had about 12,000 accounts. Only a couple hundred were related to religious matters. Everything else was Vatican family, CIA.
And we're talking big money.
Aha! You're talking trillions. You're talking about much of the world's wealth, yeah. There was so much wealth, Jerm, that what happened was in Vietnam, in Australia, really, outside Vietnam, the CIA established the Nguyen Han Bank. And in Pakistan, they established the PCCI. These were enormous banks, some of the wealthiest banks in the world. And the officials, if you look at who were the directors of the Nguyen Han Bank, they were all CIA spooks. And the purpose of that bank was to launder money from the heroin trade from Southeast Asia into Europe and then into Africa and into the United States. So these banks were set up. And once again, the Operation Gladio continued to expand. It expanded into the years of lead in Italy. It expanded into the toppling of governments in Bolivia, in Chile, in Brazil, Paraguay. It expanded to the topplings of governments in Turkey and Iran and other countries throughout the world.
All in the name of anti-communism.
Because communism, once again, it was the real motivation might have been communism, but the end result was control of the world's resources.
And it was also involved with internal conflicts within Italy.
Well, yeah. Oh, from 1969 to the Bologna bombing in 1981, the years were called the years of lead. Throughout Italy, massive attacks would occur, explosions would occur. Hundreds of people would be killed. And it was all blamed on the Red Brigades. These are the communists seeking to disrupt, you know, the affairs of Italy. No, it was all controlled by Gladio. There were Gladio units. All this came to light through the Church Committee, through the Kerry Committee in the United States. We know that. See, once you have a strategy of tension where you have people afraid, that's when you would allow the, you know, people coming in to suppress what's happening within the country. That strategy of tension prevailed throughout much of Europe, and it still prevails.
And of course, they worked hand in hand with, as you said, the CIA, MI6, Mafia, even Mossad, perhaps.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Once again, what happened, Jerm? Let's look back at the fall of Saigon, which wasn't supposed to happen. What happened in Vietnam, how we got involved, and people forget this, but it affected my life because we had a draft here. Everybody got called to serve in the military. But what happened was in 1965, Lyndon Baines Johnson, our president, went on national television. The news was interrupted so he could make this monumental announcement that in the Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam, the North Vietnamese had attacked American vessels and hundreds of American soldiers had been killed and their bodies were floating in the Gulf of Tonkin. And it was a blatant attack on the U.S. forces, and therefore we had to provide a military response. Ironically, anybody looked at, never happened. Never happened. There was no attack on the U.S. fleet. There were no dead bodies, no sailors. None of it happened. It's similar to incidents that occurred, like, for instance, in Yugoslavia with the Serbs. Announcements were made that, oh, you know, in Serbia, we have found mass graves where the Serbs are killing the ethnic Albanians. Millions are being killed. We're seeing that right now in the Ukraine. All these bodies are being, all this, it's all false. They're all false flag attacks. The things that have brought us into war after war after war, including our, the U.S. Presence in the Middle East right now, we're all false flag attacks.
That is actually hair-raising.
Well, it's true, and people need to know it. That's why I'm appearing on your show. I'm not trying to sell a book. I'm not trying to make a public appearance as this fuzzy old man here. No, I'm not doing anything. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's things that you know that are profoundly true have to be proclaimed. People are living in great, great ignorance right now. Everything you're told, practically everything you're told, is not true.
What was, is it called Propaganda Duo P2? It involved Freemasons.
Yeah. What happened was, let's go into the early 1960s and late 1950s. These people, the Gladio units that existed, were they had to meet to coordinate their activities. I mean, you can't just have chaos. You know, all these things were planned. The years of lead were planned. What was taking place in Latin America was planned and engineered and orchestrated. So where are you going to meet? You're not going to meet in the, you know, in government meeting halls. Where could you meet? The one place where you could meet in private and in secret were Masonic lodges. That's going back in the 1950s. So what you had there is the formation of Masonic lodges like P2, Propagation Dewey, or Propaganda 2, that sprouted up in Italy. And this is where they met to plan what was going on. Many of the leading cardinals of the Roman Catholic Church were directly tied to P2. All of this came out. The P2 list was published throughout Italy. All of this is basically common knowledge. You have Pope Paul VI, for instance, who was deeply tied into this, who Montini, that was his original, Giovanni Montini, he worked for the CIA in Milan before he rose to the, and his election was even, I mean, that was engineered. All of this was engineered, carefully orchestrated, but one way that it could be orchestrated was through Masonic lodges. And that's why when it came out that leading Catholic prelates were members of Masonic lodges, it sends shockwaves, especially throughout the Catholic world, because a mortal sin in the Catholic Church, I am Catholic, People think I'm a Baptist. I'm born, raised. My name is Williams. I'm an Irish Catholic. I know the Roman, and I worked for the Catholic Church for a great part of my life. I was the editor of the Fellowship of Catholic Scholars, you know, on and on. But in any case, the leading Catholic in the Catholic Church at that time, if you became a member of a Masonic lodge, it merited, not merited, it sanctioned, demanded immediate excommunication. It was a sin so grievous that you could not be forgiven by your parish priest. You could not join any secret society except the Knights of Columbus. Freemasonry was condemned by the Catholic Church in encyclical after encyclical after encyclical from the time of the French Revolution to the reign of John Paul the 23rd. So it's deeply ingrained. So the fact that they were meeting in Masonic lodges, that was as shocking to the Catholic world as I think anything that has occurred.
Since you are Catholic, would you mind explaining to me, if possible, how did the Vatican or the Catholic Church defend its involvement with Gladio?
You know, it's a long story. It evolved into really so-called making the world safe for democracy. That was the catchphrase. But it was really to gain control of the world's wealth, which is really going on right now, especially where you are. The Catholic Church, of course, provided the bank. They provided covert activities, including during the 1990s, using Gladio funds in Poland, with John Paul II, emerged as Pope, to support Solidarity. They were Gladio funds. And you had this sprouting germ of liberation theology throughout Latin America. Now, liberation theology is theology that calls upon the church to be controlled by the people, basically a communist movement. But it threatened the entire hierarchy of the church, and it spread like a cancer throughout South America. So all of these things, you know, the church managed to keep them in check with funds that were coming from. But let's talk directly about the church's involvement, because this is important. It really came to when John Paul II, we could even go to John Paul I, who was assassinated, but let's start with John Paul II. The church, through the Italian mafia, established a series of shell companies in Panama, largely in Panama. And this was because money was now coming from the cartels in South America for cocaine, and they need someplace to launder their money. Well, the money went from these shell companies, which were set up by Parmar Sinkus, the head of the Vatican Bank, Vatican officials, and the CIA. The money would flow from, like I said, Pablo Escobar and company into these shell companies, and the shell companies, in turn, would send money to the Vatican. Also, the shell companies needed more and more and more money. So what they began doing is drawing huge loans from various banks, most notably Banco Ambrosiano in Milan. They would use the money to buy shares of Banco Ambrosiano that they controlled. The head official there was by the name of Roberto Calvi. He was the head of the Banco Ambrosiano. And he would say that they would buy shares and Calvi would say, oh, guess what? The value of the shares has now risen. The shares have to split, and they have to split again and again. So the shares became extremely, extremely valuable. And the money was all coming from the cocaine trade into these shell companies. And the Vatican said, oh, these companies serve a parochial. They sent a letter of patronage affirming that these countries serve a parochial purpose. They serve the mission of the church. They didn't perform any church function, any ecclesiastical function at all. And what happened was these shell corporations that kept expanding and expanding and expanding the shell corp. There was one in Luxembourg, one in Liechtenstein, and there were six in Panama. They became, what happened was in the 1970s, you're way too young to remember this, with Jimmy Carter and the World Bank and the formation, what happened was you had incredible inflation that occurred at the end of the 1970s. So the money that was in these shell companies due to inflation was becoming, the shares were becoming lesser, lesser, and lesser value. So until all these share companies collapsed, Banco Ambrosiano collapsed. Most of the people who invested in Banco Ambrosiano were pious Catholics. They all lost their life savings. This occurred in 1982, 1983. It's the largest financial scandal in recorded history. And people were left destitute. And once again, it was part of the church's operation, and it exposed the church to their involvement in Gladio and covert activities. But it was a huge scandal.
How big is Gladio? I know you're going to say it's massive, but I'm trying to get some sort of tangible idea. Does it have members in the hundreds or the thousands or what?
Even at the onset of Gladio, you were talking of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of gladiators involved in stay behind units. Naturally, that expanded with the expansion of the CIA. They would say, you know, we're sending exploratory forces into Vietnam. We're sending exploratory forces into Africa. We're sending exploratory forces into the Ukraine. So to answer your question, I don't think that anything is occurring on the world stage right now that is not very, very carefully orchestrated. Let me just give you a case in point, Jerry. And I know this is an awful lot for people to comprehend, and I think that they have to read and they have to research on their own. Let's look at the Ukraine, okay? Because otherwise we'd be looking at every country throughout the world. Let's just use that as a paradigm. What happened in the Ukraine? There are three parts of the Ukraine. First of all, you have the western portion of the Ukraine, which is really inhabited by Poles. People there speak Polish. They have a Polish culture. They have a strong affinity to Poland. People in the central region of the Ukraine are the real Ukrainians. They have ties that date back to their ties to Nazi Germany. And Zelensky and company were strongly supported by the neo-Nazis. That's in the middle, and they still are. Okay, let's go to the eastern Ukraine, the Donbas region, okay? The Donbas region is the only region of the Ukraine that's worth a hill of beans. It's incredibly rich in oil, in natural gas, in uranium, incredibly wealthy. Now, the people who inhabit that region of the Ukraine are Russians. That it was part of the USSR. They're Russians. They're native Russians. They speak Russian. They have a strong affinity to Russia, Mother Russia. And when they held an election, recent election, just a few years ago, they voted to become part of the Russian Federation. Now, this is a fact. You can't ignore it. They voted. The people voted. They were Russians in that part of the Donbas region. They didn't want to be part of the Ukraine. They voted in a free and open election to become part of the Russian Federation, to unite with Putin. There was no invasion of the Ukraine. They voted to become part of the Russian Federation. So when Putin entered the Donbas region, he was done. He was coming into that region due to the invitation from the eastern Ukrainians completely. It was nothing. It wasn't an invasion. But the point is about it. Our involvement, the involvement of Gladio, was there's way too much at risk there to lose. There's wealth. Once you start dealing with areas like the Donbass, and you extend into Georgia, and you extend into Azerbaijan, extend into the Caspian Sea, which goes from in the northern regions of the Caspian Sea, goes to Russia, goes to Afghanistan, and at the bottom of the Caspian Sea is located Iran and Iraq. That's where a great deal probably most of the world's Africa remains untapped. Let's put that on there. That's untapped. This already exists. These oil fields, natural gas fields, this enormous wealth already exists there, including the poppy fields of Turkey. They already exist there. So let me tell you, do you know who the head of the Chamber of Commerce in Azerbaijan was? This is how deeply rooted is it. Henry Kissinger. No, I can't make these.
What are the odds? What are the odds?
The odds, yeah. I mean, you just go beyond. It's very transparent if you look at it. But once again, we can't let that wealth from the Caspian Sea. And that's why you have the invasion of Iraq, which made no sense at all. To this day, we know that Saddam Hussein never did anything against. He was our great ally during the 1980s in the Iran-Iraq war. He was our great, we called him the lion of the Middle East. We supported him. And suddenly, when he tried to regain his oil fields in Saudi Arabia, he became this awful villain that, you know, we had to oppose and attack by military force and eventually topple and kill in Africa, Gaddafi. I mean, what did he do against the United States? Do you know what he did? He possessed one of the wealthiest countries and most advanced countries in Africa. He was absolutely no threat to us at all. Part of gaining, presenting these people as horrible villains. What did Putin never do to the United States? I'm not meaning to defend him, but I mean, what has he ever done against us? What has he ever done against the Western world? I mean, what has he done against Christianity? I'll tell you one thing that he did for Christianity that nobody did. He erected a huge statue of Jesus in Syria. The way he's presented, oh, we have, that's right now in our current elections. Oh, our number one enemy is Putin. Why? How vast is Gladio? Gladio is still very much prevalent throughout the Middle East, very much prevalent throughout Europe, very much present throughout the Balkans.
How much knowledge historically have U.S. presidents had of Gladio?
Well, I told you in the beginning, you cannot be forgotten. Nobody should ever forget that the CIA in Operation Gladio was started by prominent bankers. That's where it began. How were the operations continued of Gladio? They were continued by the plans that were adopted by the Council of Foreign Relations in the United States, which was all really controlled by bankers, international bankers. And all these operations have served the benefit of money cartel. Unless you look at the head of the snake, and the head of the snake is the money cartel. And the money cartel consists of extremely powerful banking figures, extremely powerful controllers of centralized banks, including the Federal Reserve, and extremely rich and powerful corporations. By and large, corporately, you're talking about the U.S. election. The U.S. election, who was the number one contributor to the campaigns, to the past, let's look at the past American election. I could go back and back and prove it time and time again. Right now, people listen to us. Just go to your computers. You know that Joe Biden defeated Donald Trump in 2020, okay? Who were the number one contributors to the Biden campaign? I'm not talking about individual corporation contributors. That's nickel and dime stuff. Who were the number one corporate contributors to the Biden campaign? And who are the number one contributors to the political campaigns that are taking place right now in the United States? They're two corporations. They control everything. They control
BlackRock.
Yes, exactly. BlackRock and Vanguard. Who owns BlackRock? BlackRock is owned by Vanguard. Who owns Vanguard? Come on. BlackRock.
It's circular.
And sir, exactly. And it's impenetrable. Totally, I have tried my best. But every major corporation throughout the world, every major name a major corporation, name a major bank, financial concern, name CNN, Fox News, CBS, NBC. Who are the major shareholders? Just look at the corporate controllers. You'll find two corporations. And everybody's saying, oh, well, you know, these elections. No, what really matters is the fact that we are all, you and I, under the control of two major corporations. And I think by if you look into it deeply enough, they're the same people who initiated Operation Gladio. Major corporations. And I think by if you look into it deeply enough, they're the same people who initiated Operation Gladio.
So basically what you're saying is that the U.S. presidents are not terribly important where Gladio is concerned. They might know, they might not know. I mean, for example, Donald Trump, he probably doesn't know, or does he?
I don't think so. Well, I truly don't think, because first of all, to be a president, you don't need to be an intellectual. Second, to be a president, you don't need to be well-read. World affairs do not happen in a haphazard manner. I mean, we see too much. So I would say that people who doubt this, look at any major corporation that our listeners right now are interested in. Berkshire Hathaway, Wells Fargo Bank, Carnegie Mellon Bank, the World Bank. Look at who controls the communications? Who controls the Wall Street Journal? Who controls the New York Times? Who controls the Washington Post? Just look at the corporate shareholders. People would say, oh, this is the most outrageous and stupid thing. Just do some research and it'll knock you right back on your heels.
You were talking earlier about heroin and the drugs in China and so on. It makes me wonder, is China today somewhat resilient to Gladio?
China right now is just like is a player. You always need a strategy of tension. Let's remember that term. If people haven't learned that what took place in Vietnam and Iraq, if they haven't learned that all of these things, even in World War II, if they haven't learned, it goes all back. It's a root that runs very, very, very deep. And I mean, people have to discover this for themselves before they die. If they want to go to the celestial kingdom with any enlightenment, they have to become aware of these things.
Is there a way that Gladio can be stopped?
No. Not that I know. I mean, the way that it could be stopped, it would be, I grew up in the 1960s and, you know, I'm a student revolutions. I look at me and see I was part of it. But it all meant nothing at all. If you have true, want to have real reform or true revolution, forget about Marx. Forget about Lenin. Real change has to be economic. That means people in the United States, when they find out what's really happening, what they are supporting, have to say, no, we're not going to pay our taxes. That's not going to happen.
And then destroy the Fed.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. That's the only way you're going to stop it.
But that looks like it is on its way. I mean, if you look at that debt ceiling, it looks very, very shaky now.
Well, a financial collapse will come, but once again, it will come to benefit those who want it to collapse. We're very much at the point in my lifetime where all of this began, and it began with Cecil John Rhodes in the dream of an elite society controlling all of the world's affairs. It began way back then. And if you want to get a grip on it, go to Rhodes, his formation of his secret society, how they mushroomed into the Pilgrim Societies. And yeah, that all began. It began in South Africa.
There was a very long-standing statue of Cecil John Rhodes here in Cape Town for the longest time. It was taken down a few years ago.
Yeah, he's still there.
Paul, this is a really, really interesting conversation, but how can I get your many books?
My books were all published by major publishers, you know, Doubleday.
Amazon.
No, not Amazon. No. You can buy them through Amazon, but they were distributed through, you know, every books. I would say if people want to begin to get a handle on this, what they should probably turn to is a book that you have is Operation Gladio.
Yep. It's a great book.
Yeah.
It's a phenomenal book. That's what this conversation is based on.
Begin there. And then go back and start looking to verify this, especially people in South Africa. Just look at the Roundtable movement. Because all of this,
yeah,
all of this is an outgrowth of that.
Just quickly, Paul, before you go, have you been to my side of the pond?
Right now, you see, I can't stand to fly. But to answer your question, I was in Morocco. That's the only place I've been. Morocco, and I was looking for some good weed.
That's quite far away.
Looking for some good weed in 1969.
All right. On that note, Paul Williams, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
It's been fun. It's been fun. You're a good guy.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportgerm.com.